So that people can join us. I'm Rebecca Williams. I'm senior editor at Michigan Radio. And these are our panelists. We have, to my immediate left, we have John Stein. He's commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. He joined the MPCA in March 2011 as deputy commissioner. Prior to joining the MPCA, John served as assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, where he was responsible for overseeing the department's public health emergency preparedness, environmental health, infectious disease prevention and control, and the public health laboratory functions. John also worked for 25 years with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources as a hydrologist and administrator specializing in shoreland, floodplain, and wild and scenic river programs, water resource management, and regulation. And then we have, next to John, we have Heather Dawson. She's an associate professor of fisheries and wildlife biology at the University of Michigan Flint. Before she joined the faculty here, she worked as a fishery biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She and her students focus on determining ways to improve the management of invasive sea lamprey in the Great Lakes by researching aspects of sea lamprey ecology and using structured decision-making tools to determine best management strategies. And then we have John Jackson. He's worked with citizens groups for the last 35 years with a focus on Great Lakes issues, waste management, water quality and quantity issues, cleanup of toxic hotspots in the Great Lakes, and public participation and consultation. Since 2014, John's been a member of the Great Lakes Water Quality Board. It's the chief advisory body to the International Joint Commission. In this role, he's been the leader in the board's investigation of the flame retardants PBDEs in the Great Lakes Basin with a focus on policies to address issues with the chemicals. John's also a Canadian advisor to the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, and he's taught waste management at the University of Waterloo for the past 8 years. So I'd like to get started asking each of you to answer this question. It's a big question, but if you could answer it in just a couple minutes each. And that is, to your mind, what's the state of the Great Lakes? And John Jackson, you can start.
So talking from a toxics perspective.
Yes.
Okay, because, boy, there's a lot of other issues in the Great Lakes, not just toxic. I think the state of the minds of the people in the Great Lakes is actually a really important part of answering that question, because, and even here, I forget the title, but it's like it's a problem, toxics are a problem of the past, mm-hmm. and we use the word legacy and so on so much, mm-hmm. and it isn't just taking care of the problems of the past, but we're continuing to create new toxics problems, but somehow have developed the mentality that we've got good enough legislation now that we're not going to be bringing in new ones. And so I think the state of the Great Lakes is that they're still, in terms of toxics issues, still under threat. You've been seeing so much of the PFAS stuff recently. But there are all kinds of new chemicals we're bringing in and new processes that we're bringing in that are bringing new threats to the Great Lakes from the toxic side. But we have this tendency to think of toxics, we sort of dealt with it, we've got the system set up, we just have to make sure we implement it and follow it carefully. And it's not a legacy, we're creating new legacies for the future generations.
And I'm going to ask you more about that as well. Heather Dawson?
I guess I would say that there's hope. Things have improved, right? And that's really due to Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding, right? Over $2 billion worth going into Great Lakes projects since 2010. So you've had, before GLRI, you know, in the 20-plus years before, you know, when we started realizing the problems that are out there, you know, you had one delisted area of concern. And now you've had, since 2010, there's at least five or six delisted, and you also have a lot of reductions in beneficial use impairments, right? Things like reductions in the amount of issues with water, right, and drinking water, issues with habitat for fish, issues with fish consumption advisories and things like that. You know, there's always conflicting management objectives when it comes to fishery objectives in the Great Lakes, but I think things are improving as a whole in terms of what we've done with the GLRI funding.
And John Stein?
So I would use one word to talk about the state of the Great Lakes. Emerging is a better word from my perspective. Absolutely, can do. Thanks. So the concept, and I don't disagree with anything that's been said previously, but I would say that our understanding of where the Great Lakes are at is emerging. whether you think about the legacy of the past or the legacy of the present or what future generations will define as a legacy, I don't think we really fully can value the state of the Great Lakes effectively. There has been dramatic progress on things that we understand clearly, but there's a lot that we don't have as clear an understanding of the future. Microcontaminants of plastics will take us in the future, the emergence of PFAS and how that's going to impact the Great Lakes in the future, a number of concerns. If you just look at traditional nutrient challenges in the Great Lakes, there are not solutions yet. So there's progress on these areas of concern thanks to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, I agree with Heather. But we also have, if there are six areas of concern that are in pretty much remediation, there are 35 more that are not yet there. And so we're still fighting an uphill battle. And so I think emerging would be my answer to that question.
And so going to that point, when we talk about areas of concern, let's talk about that a little bit more. So how many did we start with? And what's driven, you've talked about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and how important that funding has been in cleaning up these areas. But
yeah,
where are we now? Where do things stand?
In terms of numbers, I know that right now at least there's over 30 areas of concern. I think there's 31, if I remember correctly.
Is that U.S. and Canada?
Yes.
42 total.
42 total. Okay.
Originally it was 42, and then it got they added Erie and it became 43, which has now been delisted Erie, but 43.
Numbers.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
It's close.
I know that GLRI funding has helped in delisting some of them, which I previously mentioned, but I know that GLRI funding is also looking at to delist another 10 of the previous five, I believe it's six, that were delisted.
Correct.
Prior, between 2010 and 2015. And they're looking to delist another 10. So in terms of areas of concern, yeah, it's getting better, but obviously we need to consider the things that both Johns have mentioned, right, and how these are going to impact in the future, and you guys can speak to that, I'm sure.
Sure, and just to jump in there, can you tell us the area of concern? Why are these places areas of concern? What kind of pollution issues are we talking about?
Well, most of them became areas of concern because they had a harbor and they had an industry.
That's right.
And contaminated sediments is... and it's the most costly part of the cleanup. And why? So if you look at areas of concern now, things like habitat restoration and so on, we've made dramatic improvements on. But the most expensive and most difficult part is cleaning up those contaminated sediments. What's the best solution? Do you put them there and cap them? Do you dredge them out? And huge evaluations on that and huge expenses. And so the main thing left over still is that. The other most expensive thing, which we have made a really dramatic improvement in, is sewage treatment plants. And they were discharging toxics or combined sewer overflows where the human waste from sewage treatment plants and the overflow when you had rainfalls rushing out into the lakes were a major contaminant. And those were expensive to fix up, but the governments have put huge amounts of money into that, federal, municipal, and state, provincial, to get those. And most of that is done now. There's still some, but most. But the sediments are the big issue still. And so a lot of them, I mean, we look at the solution. Will this become a problem in the future? We can't be sure. Is that I was visited Hamilton recently with Water Quality Board, and we went out and saw there what they call Randall's Reef, which is right off the shoreline from a couple of big steel companies. And it's basically what they call a combined disposal facility, where you put sheet metals down to the bedrock, and you put in the sediments there, still sitting in the water. It's like an island. Or last I don't know if any of you went on the Saginaw tour, and the Sludge Island is what they call it? The Channel Island, but the real name they call it. It's a CDF, and it's basically, it's contaminated sediments. What happens if the lake levels rise? Or what happens when we get, as we are getting, more, big floods? and hits one of those and washes it out, because that's what climate change is bringing us. So we have to really keep an eye on those and be really careful about those. And they'd be very expensive to do.
So I'll just do a little history lesson. The Binational Water Quality Agreement was signed by the United States and Canada in 1972. It has multiple areas of focus. Areas of concern are the first annex in the Binational Water Quality Agreement. That agreement was ratified again in 2012 by the governments of Canada and the United States. And these areas of concern are a priority for response by the two governments. And I want to just remind, I'll just tell everybody what the 14 beneficial use impairments are. The acronym is BUI. That's what those of us who do the work of remedying past pollution is what areas of concern is all about. Fixing past pollution to some acceptable level of control. John mentioned a CDF, which is a confined disposal facility. You take contaminated sediment, you put it in a box in the water, and you bury it. That's what you're doing. The beneficial use impairments at areas of concern are designed to fix our restrictions on fish and wildlife consumption, meaning you can eat the fish or the ducks or the wild or the mussels. Tainting of fish and wildlife flavor. These were written in 1972, so you'll get the how language has changed in 40 years. Degradation of fish and wildlife populations. Fish tumors or other deformities is number four. Number five, bird or animal deformities or reproduction problems. Number six, degradation of benthos, meaning the bottom, the sediment in the body water, and the living things in that sediment. Restrictions on dredging activities is number seven. Eutrophication or undesirable algae is number eight. Number nine is restrictions on drinking water consumption or taste or odor. Number 10 is beach closings. Number 11 is degradation of aesthetics. Number 12 is added cost to agriculture or industry. Number 13 is degradation of phytoplankton or zooplankton populations. And number 14 is loss of fish and wildlife habitat. So every one of these areas of concern went through a lengthy process to identify which of those beneficial uses was impaired. And now we're systematically working to restore them. The one area of concern in my state, in Minnesota, is in the St. Louis River estuary, which is in the harbor between Duluth and Superior. It has 11 of 14 impairments. We've eliminated two, aesthetics, which was defined as foam on the water for simple purposes. We've also, we're about to delist fish tumors because we've not found in our fisheries monitoring now tumors in the fish for quite a few years. But that's what areas of concern work is all about, is quantifying the impacts of that legacy pollution, systematically reducing it and eliminating it, and then keeping it that way, as John mentioned. That's the more poignant question is, how are we going to keep it that way?
And so that, to me, to my mind, gets to emerging contaminants, to some, on at least part of the answer to that question, right? So what are the most important emerging contaminants to your minds in the Great Lakes?
Well, I think that we're starting to see a lot of flame retardants and PFAS and things of that nature. And in the PFAS session yesterday, it was interesting. They reacted, and quite appropriately, to the word emerging and said, in our minds, they've emerged, mm-hmm. but they've been there a long time. And don't think of them like they're new things that have just come along. It's just that we've started measuring for them. And that's one of the real challenges. There are a lot of things out there that may be really bad news, but we don't know about them. We aren't monitoring for them, so we don't know, even if they're there. And that's one of the problems for the future. So I think a lot of the flame retardants, we still have issues with things like PCBs that we've banned, and the levels have gone down dramatically. And that's a very positive thing, to see that if we take strong action, we can see the levels in the water and the fish and so on go down. But what is happening, and the scientists are telling us, is that they're sort of stabilizing, if not slightly coming back up again, slightly, not like it was before. And because, you know, what's coming out of the sediments still that we've out in the open waters, even below the open waters, not just in the harbors where we're doing the cleanup, but downstream and so on. And what is, it's not like we got them out of the system completely. And it's one of the problems with allowing these contaminants to never be used in the first place, become a contaminant, is yes, we can make huge progress in not releasing more and in cleaning up the hot spots, because they're there, they're concentrated, easy to get, but they're still out in the system and will still have an ongoing impact. So the real lesson is we have to be really careful of what chemicals we are using in the first place and what chemicals we allow, new chemicals we allow to be bring into use in the Great Lakes.
Do you mind if I speak to this as well? Just yesterday I happened to see a video talk by Sherry Mason. She's a professor at State University of New York, and she was talking about plastics in the Great Lakes. And I just wanted to talk about this just because I had recently seen this. This is easily found online too, where she was talking about, you know, 230,000 particles of plastic per kilometer squared in Lake Ontario, with the other lakes having less, right? But you can see like the human influence around Lake Ontario and what that's done. And we don't know exactly how, you know, and maybe John can speak to this more, exactly how these plastics are going to make their way through the food webs, which we know they're already there, but what effects are they going to have? And so, and it's not just microplastics. It's nice that there was legislation that stopped microbeads, right, from occurring, but it's really just the breakdown in regular plastics, the single disposable plastics that we use every day really should be reduced in order to stop plastics from coming into the largest freshwater ecosystem in the world.
Right? Well, and microfibers from our fleece clothing and things that get through
wastewater treatment plants. Absolutely. That's part of it. So I just wanted to speak to that as well.
That's important.
I will just echo that same remark that really look at what sources are ongoing in across the basin. It's wastewater discharges that are incapable of removing specific contaminants, pharmaceutical products, anything that disrupts endocrinology. So our waste stream is full of very low concentrations of endocrine disrupting compounds that are well-known impactors of fish and wildlife habitat, fish and wildlife populations. We don't have a way to remove the concentrations of those compounds in wastewater. The microfibers, also important personal care products, those things that we use in our daily life that again, are not removed by wastewater treatment methods, are also emerging. Our understanding of that, I completely agree with what John said, our understanding of them is emerging. They've been there for a long time. They're not new. They're just newly understood and newly measurable compounds. PFAS is another family of chemicals, and it won't be the last. There'll be many more. And so the notion that we are, the understanding of impacts is always emerging. What we understand about risk to the ecosystems and to the human health consequences will always lag behind our ability to measure.
So what do we do about these emerging contaminants? How do we fix this?
Well, I think one of the dangers that we have is when we find something, and it'll probably start happening with PFAS, and people will say, well, yeah, our sewage treatment plants can't handle them. Well, we need to upgrade. There's something around the sewage treatment plants. We need to upgrade the sewage treatment plants. I think that's a total fallacy. First of all, why is it the responsibility for us as taxpayers and municipalities who are always broke to be, you know, putting huge amounts of expenditures into trying to deal with each of these substances in a sewage treatment plant when it's the industries and the companies that make and sell the products that have those things in it who should have the financial responsibility for getting those out of the system or not selling them with that product in, with that contaminant in it in the first place, and not up to us as the taxpayers to have to go and try to do something which is really a futile effort. I mean, the sewage treatment plants, yes, you can always make improvements, but these tiny little particles, and tiny particles really matter in the Great Lakes system. You can't expect it to ever do that. And it's putting the burden on the wrong people in terms of finding the solution and acting.
Heather or John, do you want to... the solution side?
I will talk to this, John. The term of art these days is extended producer responsibility, which is, again, a cost challenge. Who pays for the necessary response? There isn't a comprehensive responsibility law in this nation. It usually is settled in court. And this is one of the areas that I think we... binationally need to address is how are we going to think about the long-term impact in terms of front-loading the cost of it. We make a choice, and it's like many things, we prefer the lowest cost choice, when in fact the reality of our world of choices, whether it comes to food, water, or any product, is fails to account for the long-term impact of that material, its production, its use, its disposal. The life cycle of that product is really the challenge that I think we've not fully faced. We've started to face it in places around the nation. Certain states, Minnesota is one that has a extended producer responsibility for electronic waste. So when you purchase your devices, you're paying for the disposal. The industry has to have a plan to dispose of their e-waste in our state. And they have to accept that material from you at the end of its life, and they have to have a safe disposal plan. Well, I'm paying more for my cell phone, I'm paying more for everything I do electronically in my state. Nationally, I think that's way past due. But we're not there politically, and that's nothing but a political problem. Is I think the means to address it requires legislation, and I don't think we're anywhere close to that.
And first of all, I have to let people know I'm from Canada, so any biases that pop out there. But it is in the U.S. it is so much harder to push for extended producer responsibility than in a lot of the other countries. In Europe, it's just an accepted part. Industry accepts that that's just part of the world they have to operate in, and the extended producer responsibility legislation there for each type of product includes not just that they have to get it back, but also in terms of the toxic substances in, say, the electronics. They were given deadlines by which they had to have it out of the product that they sold as well. They had to get cadmium and various things out of their products before they sell them, not just to try to grab them after. In Canada, we're much further ahead on EPR, not as far as in Europe, but every province has extended producer legislation, and to get back, you're requiring industry to take a responsibility. It's far from as good as in the European system, but it is a step further, and I see that as an opportunity for us binationally to work. Totally agree with you, and it actually was a recommendation that the International Joint Commission made recently, was to say that we have to get EPR going in both Canada and the U.S. and to put the responsibility where it lies. And it's not just a financial responsibility. It's also these companies that sell you the product design the products. They decide what's going to be in it, what characteristics they want, and therefore use certain toxic things, or make it that it's, you know, basically impossible to recapture it and recycle it. A lot of the plastic items are prime examples of that. And they make those decisions when they make the design. They say, oh, it's the consumer. If they don't buy it, it won't happen. Well, why do they spend that fortune on advertising that neat little coffee, what do they call those things, the pod things or whatever. They spend a fortune advertising that.
Yeah.
Right. If the advertising doesn't work and affect consumers, they're not going to spend their fortune doing that. It clearly works. So it's not like we're free consumers in that sense. But they have to then really have the responsibility, not say consumers will decide.
So how well are the U.S. and Canada working together to clean up the lakes and tackle these issues?
Let's talk about the fishery side.
Fishery side?
Yeah.
You know, most of what I'm involved in is invasive sea lamprey control, so I can speak to that in terms of how well that works together. So, and we know the Binational Commission, the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, is a commission that's done quite a lot for the Great Lakes. And part of their charge is sea lamprey control. And I work constantly with Canadians, so the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada. When I work for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I still work with all of these people as a researcher doing research on how to improve management for sea lamprey. And it is rather tireless in terms of how people are actually working together and in doing what they can in terms of sea lamprey control. You know, spending over $27 million, right? But to protect a $7 billion fishery. So it's very important. And I talk to these people at least, I don't know, 60 times a year. I meet with them 4 times a year. And so, and it's a cutting edge program in terms of invasive species control. So I would say in that regard, you know, we're working really well together.
I agree.
And I would say, the work between the governments. So I'm on the Great Lakes Executive Committee, which is the governing body for the Binational Water Quality Agreement. And it's a very large organization. The Government of Canada, Environment and Climate Change, has got the lead. On the U.S. side, it's the Environmental Protection Agency. And then they have a supporting cast of dozens of supporting organizations. They convene twice a year. There's a lot of information exchanged about technical work that's going on those 10 annexes in the Binational Water Quality Agreement. The coordination is stellar. The progress is slow. That's government. Not only government is slow, but remedying problems in the environment is not an easily solved solution in terms of defining the most effective results means to an end. So I think that we work well together. The understanding of the problem has probably never been as high as it is today. If you look at nutrients in the Great Lakes, you look at the goals that Ontario and Michigan and Ohio have reached on nutrients in Lake Erie, for example. The focus and the clarity of the challenge before us has never been greater. The pace of progress is about the same, to be honest. And it's slow.
It's interesting being involved with both the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and with the Great Lakes water quality stuff. And I know that the cooperation across the border in terms of the fish is working out much better than we're finding on the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. I think one of the reasons for that may be that there aren't as many agencies involved, that there's such a wide range of issues. But I've been so impressed how really they're, in fact, making decisions jointly in joint Canada-U.S. committees on invasives and on a wide range of fish issues. So stocking, I'm on the advisory committee of Lake Ontario, and it's becoming a crisis now with people, you know, what they call the prey fish, which I hate calling some fish, ones that are there only to be eaten, are the alewife, and they've had some bad winters and froze, and they're being, now they can't handle be enough food for the ones at the top of the food chain. But they're making decisions on stocking together in joint committees. Mm-hmm. And that's the only reasonable way to deal with a system where fish don't know where the borders are, toxins don't know where the borders are. On the water quality agreement, I think it's much harder to do because of that vast number of agencies that you spoke on. But it's finding it's not so much sitting down together in the same way. There are, each annex has a committee, a subcommittee is supposed to do that, and they have some outside, allow some outside advisors on them. And I'm on the toxic committee, for example. And boy, has that one been frustrating recently, in that we go on calls, regular calls, and to give you an indication, calls that are booked for an hour, you know, are done in half an hour to 40 minutes. Because we've got into the situation where, and I feel so sorry for the U.S. civil servants, where you ask, say, okay, where's that report that was going to be ready by now? Well, it's upstairs. It's at headquarters. And we have no idea when it's going to come back. You know, the Chicago office is takes the lead on the Great Lakes. And then you'll say other things like, some things we really need to do, and they all agree, yes, we really need to do it. And of course, US EPA has to say, well, but we know we haven't got the money for it. In terms of dealing with toxics, on our last call, she said, we're down now to 1.5 full-time equivalent to deal with the water quality agreement and toxics. Not the whole water quality agreement, but the toxics part under the water quality agreement. So it's really been devastating in terms of that. But, you know, other times it's been the Canadian side that's the problem.
Yeah.
And the irony I have found, I've been involved until I'm older, for over 30 years on Great Lakes water quality issues binationally. And we never seem to get both a president and a prime minister who are really care about the environment at the same time. And I dream of the day. Like, okay, so when Obama was there, you know, now Trudeau on the Canadian side, he cares about environment. He has a progressive view on it. But, you know, we have to do these things jointly. And when Obama was there, we had a Harper government who, you know, environment wasn't something he was going to put resources into. And it's been that way all the way back. And so we never can get it together. That's my dream. And if you can do anything to try to get that synchronicity going, the Great Lakes will be in phenomenal shape. But we also don't want two bad ones at the same time.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Then we could be in bad shape too, so I don't know.
Is that the biggest challenge that you see, is the political leadership?
The binationally, there's a lot of challenges binationally. It's wonderful. That's why I work binationally. It's the most exciting thing to do. Your perspectives grow. You get totally new understandings. And it's almost like we have a family across the border. It's amazing. We talk about the Great Lakes family, which includes government, includes some industries, it includes environmental activists, municipalities, the academics, who feel like we're part of this Great Lakes community. But simple little things are starting to hurt that community. One of them is, on both sides of the border, is restrictions on travel. You know, getting approval for out-of-state or out-of-country or out-of-province or out-of-country travel. And so more and more of the work is being done on conference calls and webinars, and we don't get together in the same way. And that really breaks down the community. I can see the deterioration in the community. So it's that getting to know each other and getting to really learn from each other and the different perspectives that come from both sides of the border in terms of methods and so on. It's really exciting, and it's an amazing potential, but it's hard to keep going. We don't even always speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
And simple little things like, tabling a motion. You know, if here you table a motion, it means someone's delaying. You know, in Canada, tabling a motion means we're immediately voting. It's on the table to be voted on now. And I've had so much misunderstandings over simple things like that. So, you know, but it's fun getting to know each other, so it's worth it.
I really, I agree with John, that limitation on the face-to-face conversation. The challenge with the Water Quality Agreement is also the breadth of the issues and the complexity of the resource itself. what's a problem on Lake Erie is not a problem on Lake Superior. There's not ever going to be a nutrient challenge in Lake Superior as a whole. There's going to be nutrient challenges in subparts of Lake Superior, around the Apostle Islands, for example. There are, but there will never be the same kind of a challenge on Lake Superior as you'd have on any of the shallower bodies of water. Same for fisheries. The fisheries are completely different between the lakes. That diversity is one of our greatest strengths. It's also one of the greatest challenges we face, is getting the right focus. And the other thing I just, on a human side, I wanted to bring up, and John and I were talking about this at breakfast this morning, the reality that most of the people doing the work are now aging out of the work force. So most of us have been doing this work starting in the 70s or 80s, and we're all now coming to the end of our careers, and we're gradually being replaced, but nowhere near at the level that we were funded or started doing our jobs 40 years ago. And so the reality is there's fewer people. The expertise and the knowledge transfer is a challenge of both the successes that we've enjoyed, but also the challenges and mistakes that we've made along the way. So I really feel like this knowledge transfer problem is just going to keep cropping up over and over again. And every time that occurs, we lose ground and we spin our wheels a bit longer to get everyone on the same page again. That's a real challenge on such a complex binational ecosystem. And the other thing that I think you'll find as we talk about this is the economic stresses that motivate governments. And the economy of the Great Lakes is characterized as the third or fourth largest in the world, depending on how you count economies. It's a huge driver of opportunity or threat. Governments are much more tuned to dealing with economic threats than they are environmental ones. And so I'm always concerned by progress on the environment being jeopardized by needed response on the economic side. It's always going to trump the conversation if economics become the challenge. If those two things go the wrong direction in both Canada and the U.S., then this will slide off the table altogether. So that's another challenge that I think confronts us, is as long as the economy is growing, we should be making faster progress. That's what worries me. The economy in the U.S. is expanding dramatically, and we're not investing in the resource. That's foolish.
All right, we're going to open it up for questions now. And just a reminder, SEJ's policy is journalists and SEJ members can ask questions first. You can just introduce yourself when you have a question, and then I'll repeat your question since we're recording this. Yes?
Jim Ellis with Bridge Magazine. We're not properly covered in Michigan. So piggybacking on what you said, John Dunstein, do you see beyond government's focus on economics, is there also a problem with focus on like the short-term political gains versus long-term? Because especially in Michigan, we keep finding ourselves paying a lot more later once something is a huge crisis than if we had just prevented it.
So the question is, you want to repeat the question? Go ahead.
So the question is, are we always in, you know, sort of responding to the crisis of the day, rather than really getting ahead of that conversation on preventing future crises? And the answer to that is always going to be yes, in my opinion. Governments are notoriously responsive. They're best when they're responsive. They're worst when they're preventive. You can see it in my background in public health, that prevention of disease, for example, is long understood by our parents' generation, pasteurization of milk, immunization against infectious diseases. All of those things have been proven technologies, but the fear that people are now being driven by is an unknowable risk of some sort. So preventing things is a challenge for a social body like political appointees or elected officials, because people want assurance of return, whether it's a return on investment or that we're doing the right thing, that it's going to actually prevent things. The reality is we're actually telling people we don't know much as we used to tell them we knew. When we were solving problems with infections and we had penicillin, you could tell people what they were actually solving. Today, you invest in a prevention strategy, what we're unable to tell people is how effective that prevention strategy will be in the future. And that is one of the challenges that elected officials and governments have on a wide range of things. So I'd like to say that we're not investing enough, but I think it's rational why we're not. Because the questions are getting broader, deeper, and more confounding. And so people are unclear what should we spend our resources on. That's where elected officials are challenged. So I think I laid out the problem the first way. Now I'm trying to talk as though I'm a elected person trying to say, but tell me where to spend my money. It's pretty darn hard. And I don't think we have a good answer for them. So that's the challenge that we're going to have to face, is greater increasing levels of uncertainty on both the understanding side and on the investment side.
Garrett?
Garrett Ellison, MLive and the Grand Rapids Press. Earlier you mentioned that we're going to be dealing with new problems. PFAS is sort of the latest and what's expected to be in line, challenges, emerging issues, et cetera. Is there an appetite for adding new areas of concern as...
no way.
I've heard the reason I ask is that there's been sort of muted discussion about trying to add the Oscoda area,
right,
the Oswego River as a new area of concern related to the PFAS issue coming up, the words with the Air Force Base. And, the people who were trying to push that were told, look, we're delisting. We're not listing new ones. So is that something that should be rethought, or is that just how things are going?
So just to repeat the question,
okay,
so Garrett's asking, is there an appetite for adding new areas of concern?
Certainly not among those who have been working on cleaning up the old ones. And there is a provision in the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement for adding new ones. Both federal governments have to approve any addition, and IJC can make recommendations on those, but the two governments add it. And they're really... there's an immediate, strong negative reaction when you suggest it, because people think back from, it's 85 that we started these cleanup processes, the areas of concern, and it's taken huge resources, etc. The other reason there's a huge negative reaction is, even among the people living in the community, not just the, is I don't want that negative mark on my community. I don't want to be called an area of concern, and many of us, like me, call them toxic hotspots. I don't want to have that negative connotation attached to my community. So the provision is there. It's legally possible to do it. You need to get both federal governments to agree. But good luck at achieving it.
So is there some other better route then to deal with
So part of the challenge is in the U.S. we would, you could list them as Superfund sites if the material was defined as toxic. So the challenge you have on some of these compounds that are just sort of becoming aware of them is they're not yet listed. And so the listing process takes a very long time. And by the time we would list a site for PFAS, I'm imagining it might be a couple decades or more from now. And that's no longer socially acceptable in my sort of view of the political social realities. It's just not an acceptable thing. So I think we need a different thing. We need something other than an area of concern, something other than Superfund or brownfield listing, because those are well-defined, and no one wants... I mean, the last time we've modified a national environmental law, we modified the Toxic Substances Control Act in 2016 or 2017. That's the only act that's actually been substantively changed in the last 25 years in the U.S. And that gives you a sense of how much appetite there is for
environmental law, new environmental law at the national level. There isn't any. And so what we're going to get is maybe states will innovate on this, and that has been the field of environmental law making is at state levels. So maybe there'd be work that a couple of states could do together that would focus on that challenge, but I don't ever see it happening in my lifetime based on current politics. It's just not likely.
Yeah, if I can add to that, in addition, I think what we're coming to realize is that, well, PFAS, for example, it's not just to go to 10 sites and clean them up. These some of them become widespread. Mm-hmm. And most of the chemicals we are becoming aware of now aren't just in, you know, 43 hot spots. And we need a strategy that will deal with them not just in the areas that were designated, but also elsewhere. And one of the things is you do hear people get really upset. I live on the in the Grand River, the Ontario Grand River. There's so many Grand Rivers in the Great Lakes, where they made Agent Orange in the community just north of me in Elmira. They made Agent Orange during the war. And so all the wastes of dioxins and furans and all those and incredible waste that devastated Vietnam are there, and they're doing cleanup and so on. But they say, well, we should be an area of concern. And these are a lot of small communities have these same problems. And so what we're needing instead are strategies that will work beyond just the biggest ones that we designated to take care of the other communities as well. Those are harder to do. Take more effort, but in the long run, they'll be more successful.
Other questions? Get.
I mean, I have.
Jump in.
Probably throw questions at you all day. I read a lot about PFAS, and we're seeing drinking water systems in Michigan are pulling in PFAS from Lake Michigan, from Lake Huron, but we're not seeing it in the Detroit water system, which is interesting considering that we are getting it in the Saginaw municipal supply, and it's coming in the Tawas system, which is, downstream, so to speak, through the Great Lakes from the El Salvador River. Grand Haven has got it, and their intake is very close to the Grand River tributary, the Michigan's Grand River. Is there a good strategy for dealing with this, system-wide, other than just, water treatment plants should start planning for activated carbon filtration or some other type of technology that takes this stuff out, assuming that it starts to be found at levels that, are designated concerning regulatory and that sort of thing?
So you got to my first point last. Your question was, what should we do strategically about PFAS, for example? How should we just plan to treat? Should that be sort of the strategy? Your last point was about what are we going to do when we detect it? And the nature of this compound is it will be detected everywhere.
Yeah.
That it's just a question of when. The nature of the compound, the family of compounds, is a very high surfactant ratio, meaning it travels very quickly over the surface of water and is not bound to anything. The only way you can bind it to something is to really heat it up or chemically bind it in a very intentional way, the way Teflon pans are coated, the way paper is coated, the way that all the applications of these compounds have been used. So first of all, I would say the rational strategy is to detect, is to look. First of all, don't fail to look and get a broad awareness of its existence. The second problem is we do not know yet what exposure risk ought to be. So there's this notion that we found it and therefore it's bad. We know that it has some toxicological characteristics that are dangerous. Thyroid conditions, a range of endocrinology concerns, in addition to low birth weights in children and so forth. So there are certainty or emerging certainty around risk, but we don't know what that risk should be calculated to be nationally yet. So you're going to have people responding before they have a goal. And when we do this, we're going to overspend if you look at it from one side of the equation, because you're seeking to eliminate a problem that you don't yet know how dangerous it is. This is the nature of future responses, in my view. You're going to know something before you can characterize the risk of something effectively. Developing a maximum contaminant level in drinking water is going to take decades for EPA to do. Before that's done, people are going to demand responses at the community scale. It is how to fund it is really the more relevant question, because you're going to have to respond. Community members are not going to let you just say, wait for the MCL and we'll know what to do. That's not an acceptable option when people's health is at risk. We in Minnesota, our attorney general sued 3M and settled for $890 million to address drinking water problems. So we have $890 million to spend in 10 communities in the East Metropolitan area to solve, to actually think long term. In the short term, we're treating. We're filtering and we're providing alternate drinking water to people on private wells. That's short term. So I think my version of the answer to your question is, don't think about solving it. Think about getting to step one, which is providing people with safe drinking water, pure and simple. Then start debating how to get to the long term. And I think this is where attorneys have great value, because someone should pay. And the people didn't choose this problem. Someone created this problem, and it's usually, you know, it's either in the government or in private sector, and that's where we ought to solve it, is in litigation.
So, John Stein, you mentioned that governments are often at their worst when they're trying to be preventative. How does that play into the PFAS problem?
Well, the good news is, companies like DuPont and 3M agreed to eliminate certain chemistries in the early 2000s. They did not agree to stop using the basic chemistry, though. So they replaced bad chemistry with unknown chemistry. So now I'm with John. When you talk about the European Union and you talk about their precautionary approach, which is, we ought to stop developing new compounds. My view is, let's return to things that are inert and stable in the environment. Glass is inert and stable in the environment. We have indulged our chemistry for convenience to the extreme. And we got to stop. Like, I'm glad that we're all getting stainless steel straws at this event, for example. We demand low-cost convenience. And until we replace that with something more holistic and relative to environmental protection, public health, we're gonna keep bequeathing these sins on the future. So government is terrible at this. We're always going to lag behind. Consumers are also terrible at it until they mobilize awareness and actually change people's values. It can be done, but it's very slow.
Other thoughts?
I guess I would just go back to, you know, what Sherry Mason had said about plastics getting into the Great Lakes, and, you know, and maybe there's a, I don't know how it would be legislated, but, you know, cost of plastic bags, cost of plastic, so to the point where consumers are literally using other things, right? You know, and then the cost just to use cloth shopping bags, for example, you know, makes more sense to them than actually paying a tax on a plastic bag every time they go grocery shopping. You know, it's things like that, and obviously mobilization of consumers themselves, right? The straw issue. But just the elimination of single disposable use items made of plastic, I mean, would make a big, huge difference, right? You know, floss sticks, right? Do we really need a big, giant piece of plastic holding a little piece of floss? I mean, it's more convenient for my 7-year-old, but, you know, can she manage to use, right? And so it's just little things like that, and that's just one piece that I wanted to speak to, that's all.
I can add, I think the main lesson that I hope we're learning, I don't have confidence yet that we're learning it, but I keep being told, for example, did this work on flame retardants with the International Joint Commission, for example, and one of the issues we stressed in it was substitution, you know, with new flame retardants, which so frequently show up, you know, as being a problem 10 years down the road. And the lesson, and I've both on Environment Canada and EPA side, been assuring me, John, why are you even discussing that issue? It's not an issue. We'll never allow things like that onto the market again. I don't believe that for a second. And because, and so I think the lesson I hope we learn out of this is we have to know that before we introduce a new substance or a new process. And so I'll use some example of PCBs, and in terms of process, I'll use the example of nuclear power plants. So we brought PCBs on. We need to know what happens after use. Do we know how to handle them after use in a so-called safe way? We so frequently bring on substances and we make the assumption, well, some they'll figure it out later. And often the characteristic we like about it, PCBs, for example, that it high temperatures, you know, it prevents fires in electrical equipment at higher temperatures, it can withstand that, is the very characteristic that makes it so dangerous in the environment, that it accumulates, that it builds up in the system, it builds up in the food chain, and affects birds, fish, and humans. Is the very characteristic that we put it in the product for. So we need to be making sure we're addressing that. And now that we know we don't want it, we banned it, but it's still in the system, we can't totally get rid of it, how do we deal with it? How do we dispose of it? And so you burn it, you have to have high temperatures, the temperatures often create dioxins and furans in the very same process. We don't think about that. And the other example is processing. So we bring a new technique on, and I'll use nuclear power plants as an example. And we knew at the time we didn't know how to deal with the high-level radioactive waste, which is the fuel. But we said, and I don't know how many engineers are in the room, but anyway, we said our engineers will find a solution. You know, we operate on total confidence that they can find a solution. We're now 60, 70, almost 70 years. We started these in the 50s. Almost 70 years down the road, and we still don't have in either Canada or the United States a disposal site for those fuels. They're all in storage, mostly next to the nuclear power plants, those fuels that have been taken out of use. And we're still saying, well, we'll find a solution. And the critical thing is, I mean, for example, both Canada and the United States have set similar requirements in terms of the disposal of that high-level radioactive waste in terms of the goal. The goal is that we have to keep it separate from the environment for, and they use different words, but they all say the same thing, a million years, millennia, forever. But they're all basically saying the same thing, that we have to keep it separate from the environment that long. Well, did we ever really think we could do that? So I hope the lesson we're learning is that we don't bring some exciting new product onto the market unless we know that we have a solution at the end to get rid of it and deal with it if it becomes a problem, and that we have a way to deal with it after use. And we're still not doing that. I mean, the the curry pogs or whatever it is. I find it hard to say the word because it so horrors me. Makes me so upset. But so they bring these great pods on, and then surprise, municipalities say we can't recycle these things, and it's worse than can't recycle. They're messing up our system because they're small, they clog up the machinery where we're trying to separate the recyclables, and so it's messed all that up. And then they come in, the industry comes, and so they start getting a reaction from the public as well as the municipalities. And then they come and say, well, we'll redesign them to make them compostable or recyclable or whatever. And sorry, you should have done that before you put them on the market, not now. And that's the lesson I hope we'll all learn. And I hope you as journalists can sort of keep your eyes open when you're looking at some exciting new thing and say, okay, ask the questions about what's going to happen. What are you going to do with that after the life of it? What are you going to do with it when it's no longer usable? That's, anyway, I've said it. But it's a really important question for all of you to be asking as journalists when you see this exciting new idea out there. And I don't want to be a downer at exciting new ideas. I love them. But ask the right questions.
Any other questions? We have time for a couple more.
Yeah, earlier you were discussing extended producer responsibility for, and John, I think you mentioned that in Minnesota you pay more for chronic devices, right? And John, you said, you know, the idea with wastewater plants is that upgrading them is putting the burden of dealing with the problem on the taxpayers, right? Well, isn't that kind of the same thing in some ways, right? The consumer or the public is paying for it either at the beginning of the process by paying more for the product or at the end of the process paying more taxes to deal with it. You know, am I misreading that somehow, or...
Are you wanting to repeat the question before?
Yeah. So the question was about, you know, extended producer responsibility and the cost. Who actually pays the cost of extended producer responsibility? The consumer or the producer? Producer can't make, you know, can't internalize most of the cost. That's reality. And I would say that current laws or the current application of extended producer responsibility is. It presumes that we need everything we use, that and that we actually demand it. That's one thing that I think is John's raised that question really well and wisely. The second part is, it's probably an interim approach. Yes, consumers are only those who use those products are actually paying that extended producer cost. If you choose to avoid that cost, then you're not paying. So the difference between a wastewater treatment facility, which is the rates are spread out universally across everyone, which you could have a debate about that, whether that's the right thing to do. Should we pay more based on contribution to the problem? That's a new rate theory that people might want to debate. But overall, the difference on extended producer responsibility is you're making the choice to purchase the material or the product, and then that's when you pay. We do it for paint in our state too. We have a extended producer response, or you pay a $2 per gallon fee on your purchase of a gallon of paint. Then you bring back the company that anybody that sells you the paint has to take your leftovers back. You bring it, they take it, no charge. So you don't have to take it to a recycling facility. They're the ones, they bought into the system of selling you paint. If you don't use it all, they take it all back. And they have to then responsibly put it back into use into a new product or dispose of it safely. That's our law in Minnesota, for example. Another way, but almost everybody paints. That's a little different than like electronics, where not everyone has to use them, but they're becoming pretty much ubiquitous. So it's maybe an interim, imperfect solution on extended producer responsibility.
I want to say a couple things on that. And you know, we were talking earlier about the importance of education of consumers and consumers making choices. The catch is on that is that so frequently to buy a better product, like I'm sure that straw that we were given is more expensive than the plastic straw, and so it's costing you more. Unfortunately, I think that the extended producer responsibility fees are not high enough, that they're not taking into the full real environmental costs, and that's basically because industry fights higher fees. But if those fees were at the appropriate level, going to the alternate, better solution, like that straw, would actually end up being a cheaper choice. And instead now, we're pushing the consumer to more expensive choices if they want to do it right. So that's one point. The other point to make legislation be truly effective, EPR legislation, and this is what Europe does, is it's not just to say you're responsible for getting it back or fees or whatever, but to have requirements around what the product itself is like. For example, that doesn't have these toxic things in it, that it is easy to disassemble, that it's not a mix of plastics. So many of those things are in the European legislation, which means that the product is designed, they force them to design the product in ways that it won't be such a problem after it's been used. And we need to include that. And Canada's not been including that. And the US legislation really hasn't been including that. We look at different mechanisms to do it. Europe is, and it makes a huge difference. And fortunately, the European system affects us, because many of the electronic companies in the US and Canada have now gotten those toxics out because they want to sell in the European market. And so they didn't have to, you know, do a whole new... So Europe's actually been doing us a favor, but we need to start doing it for ourselves.
All right. Well, we're at time now, so thank you very much to all of our panelists for coming in.
Thank you. It's fun.